Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net.
I'm Dr. Marty Gensius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, we have the first of two podcasts related to addiction and treatment. Today we hear from CAS contributing editor Amy Friedling, who speaks with Dr. Brad Price, clinical director of the Glen Bay Treatment Center, regarding adolescent chemical dependency.
Hi, this is Amy Friedling. Today I'm here with Dr. Brad Price of Glen Bay Treatment Center, located in Rock Creek, Ohio. Brad, thanks for being with me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Brad, could you tell me a little bit about your position at Glen Bay, what it is that you do?
Well, I'm the clinical director here at Glen Bay Hospital, which means essentially that I supervise all of the counseling portion, all the clinical portion of our program. Here, we basically have two subdivisions, medical and clinical, and the director of nursing and medical director oversee all of our medical components, and I have the rest, basically.
Wonderful. And Glen Bay is?
An addiction treatment hospital. We specialize in addictions treatment out here in the middle of nowhere, Ashtabula County.
A beautiful place to be indeed. Today we'll be talking a little bit about chemical dependency, substance abuse, and in particular in working with adolescents. Can you tell me a little bit more about your background in working with that population?
Certainly. I began work in addictions in 1981, and up until I began working here at Glen Bay in 2000, the vast majority of my career and experience had been working with adolescents and their families. I began the first year or so working in school systems in northern Summit County, just north of Akron, Ohio, and then moved into inpatient treatment and subsequently worked in outpatient treatment, private practice, agency work, contract work. Spent some time working in a private psychiatric hospital doing psychological evaluations and some addictions work, but it was with adolescents and the people who care about them.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So you do have a lot of experience in this area. And certainly I think this is becoming a growing concern in our society, the amount of substance use amongst adolescents.
Well, it is. One of the ways that old friends of mine and I talk about it is we're back where we were in the mid to late 70s. In northern Ohio, and a lot of people forgot this ever happened or never knew it, but in the late 70s, really 79, there was a concerted effort on the part of school districts, treatment agencies, and hospitals to develop a full continuum of treatment for adolescents. In other words, school districts across northeastern Ohio developed comprehensive drug and alcohol programs in their schools to identify students that were having problems with their use, identify students who were concerned about family members and friends who were using, to identify a population of students who were at risk for having drug and alcohol problems, as well as providing support for young people who'd been through addiction treatment and were returning to the school setting. And at one point, there were well over 200 school systems across northern Ohio that had programs, at least on the high school level, and most into the 80s expanded into elementary and middle school levels as well. Now, what went along with that were several. At one time, there were about a half a dozen hospital-based inpatient treatment centers in the greater Cleveland area, as well as Akron. For 8.5 years, I worked at one at St. Luke's Hospital on the east side of Cleveland. And there were several others as well, supplemented by public agencies and private agencies that were doing assessments, interventions, and then providing outpatient treatment for young people when they were discharged from the hospital programs. And all of this worked in conjunction with the school systems. The schools provided staff release time for paid staff and faculty, as well as incorporating community volunteers in one great effort to positively influence the using among Northern Ohio youth. And it's not a an exaggeration to say at one point in the mid-80s to the early 90s that there were several thousand people engaged in this activity, several thousand professionals and community volunteers. In the mid-90s, actually began around really around 1991, many of those programs began to be dismantled. 30 years ago, you'd see a student walking down a corridor of a high school with an 18-inch wide marijuana leaf emblazoned on their T-shirt. It wasn't too difficult to start picking out who might be using, who might be having problems with their using, and who wasn't. And that's the disciplinary problems that schools were having really motivated people to begin looking at you know, what we might do about that. Mm-hmm. That's what produced the community-wide effort to develop the programs that we did then have in the 80s. What happened, though, was around 1985, 86, 87, kids started changing styles. Fashions changed. Their drugs of choice changed. Their behavior changed. They noticed, they figured out that what was bringing them to people's attention was largely the way they looked and the way they behaved in the school setting. And they learned that if we don't do that in the school setting, we're a little bit more difficult to identify and pick out. And as styles naturally change, as they do with young people, they just didn't look the same. Mm-hmm. And what that provided was a false sense of confidence and a false sense of security among the adult population. People came to the conclusion that, well, look at this, you know, we've fixed it, it's done, it's over. High school students aren't using as they had 5, 6, 7 years ago, so we don't need to commit the resources to these programs any longer. So the money dried up, the release time for staff was hard to come by, and the natural attrition that goes with teachers, faculty, staff, and community members moving on to other endeavors in their lives, well, they simply weren't replaced. The healthcare insurers in the late 80s, and then particularly in the early 90s, simply decided that young people couldn't be addicted, did not require treatment for addiction, and they simply stopped paying claims for adolescent addiction treatment. And there were a couple of very large third-party payers at that time that the reimbursement simply dried up almost overnight from them. So that combination of factors led to the really the premature dismantling of this wonderful treatment network that we had here once upon a time. Which brings me back to where I began when I sit around reminiscing and getting nostalgic with old friends. You know, we talk about, well, it's, you know, 1978, 79, all over again, in that young people are still using just as much as they had been. The problems and difficulties arising from that use are just as difficult, just as widespread. And, you know, we're now at a point again where if communities begin paying close attention to that, they can start intervening with the young people on a community-wide basis. The problem is, we dismantled all of those systems, so it's going to be a matter of recreating the entire network, starting with school programs, community agency programs, hospital or freestanding addiction treatment facilities. We need to basically reconstruct the whole system.
So we're starting over.
Mm-hmm. We're starting over. And it's one of the things that really happens in addictions all the time is, in our society and culture, we get some funny notions about addictions. And a lot of it simply has to do with with fashion and style. What I mean by that is I've been doing this long enough now to have been through about three cycles of drug of choice. What I mean by that is right now opiates are pretty popular among younger people. When I say younger people, 28, 30 and below. Not as big with middle-aged folk, but that's just what's going on here in 2007. A few years ago, cocaine and other stimulants were much more fashionable among younger people, but they aged. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen a lot of hallucinogens for a while, but they'll probably make a comeback. I mean, they recycle about every 7 or 8 years. So what I'm saying is, you know, we'll go through these periods where a particular chemical or class of chemical will be widely used by a large segment of the population of addicts, but then fashions change, styles change, people start using other things. Mm-hmm. And that leaves the impression that folks aren't using as much. An example that I have of that are looking at some of the large surveys, especially of adolescents, that are conducted every year or two by some large research organizations. And usually the results are published in middle to late spring, and the headlines in the paper generally read something like this: blank use among teens is down, semicolon, blank use is up. Mm-hmm. And you can simply fill in the blank with whatever, depending upon the year. I mean, something's always down, something's always up. What's never reported is what the total use by any given individual adolescent happens to be. Mm-hmm. Right now, cocaine and other stimulants may not be especially popular among adolescents, so it's quite likely that those headlines are going to read that that's down. However, use of opiates, are up right now. And then the constants that are ever present are alcohol, which is virtually never included in those surveys. For a variety of reasons. And then marijuana, it remains fairly stable as well. Mm-hmm. So we go through these cycles of fashion, and it gives us this false sense that everything's getting better, when in reality it pretty much stays the same. It's just human beings being the creatures that they are, will change fashion, style, and their patterns a bit. But overall use, it's still there. Mm-hmm.
Well, earlier you had mentioned, and I like this visualization of a teenager with a marijuana leaf, mm-hmm, on their shirt, and
yes,
being very obvious that there could be a problem. I guess as a treatment professional, I'm kind of wondering how you go about assessing an adolescent for potential problems with substances.
Oh, that's a very good question. The first, which may appear rather obvious and is one of those things that could go unsaid, but I feel the need to say it anyway, is to simply state that adolescents absolutely can and are addicted to mood-altering chemicals. Now, the reason I begin there is there's still a large segment of our society, and still way too large a segment of the professional community in behavioral medicine, mm-hmm, that questions that somehow the use of mood-altering chemicals by adolescents is a developmental piece, it's some sort of anomaly, that because adolescents don't have fully developed personalities, well, they can't be addicted. I mean, I've heard these things, all of them, in various forms over the years, so I always need to begin with a recognition that adolescents certainly can and are chemically dependent. So for any professional working with them, that needs to be a given rather than excluding it out of hand. Mm-hmm. Now, a second piece that goes along with that, another that seems on the one hand somewhat obvious, but I think needs to be said explicitly, is that the use of mood-altering chemicals among the American adolescent population is fairly common. In many areas and among some subgroups of adolescents, you could even say it's typical. Mm-hmm. But simply because it's common and typical doesn't mean it's normal. And I I always have to make that point because there's too many folks in American society and culture right now that don't see adolescent use of mood-altering chemicals as being abnormal or somehow questionable. When I say abnormal, depending upon the particular chemical, all areas of adolescent development are influenced, and they're influenced negatively. The continuing physiological development adolescents are experiencing, social, cognitive, emotional, spiritual. I mean, in every way that adolescents develop, mood-altering chemicals are going to interfere with a natural course of development. Mm-hmm. Things that ought to be difficult and anxiety-producing, such as learning how to ask someone out on a date, being appropriately sociable with members of the opposite sex, is distorted when you're under the influence of mood-altering chemicals. The beginnings of discovering one's own sexuality and developing sexual activity and sexual relationships winds up being distorted by the use of mood-altering chemicals. How it is our roles and relationships in the family system develop and change as we grow through adolescence, well, that winds up being distorted by mood-altering chemicals. I mean, there's really nothing that's left untouched by mood-altering chemicals, and it's not positive. It's there's harm that's caused. Kids just don't develop as they should, and that's a huge problem. In terms of assessment, looking at all areas of the adolescent's life, as we would with any psychosocial assessment. Mm-hmm. There's nothing particularly unusual or different about doing that in regard to mood-altering chemicals, other than always including follow-up questions that are going to probe how a person's use may have affected that area. In other words, if the person's experiencing any difficulty in school, academically, specific questions asking about their pattern of use, will be very important to see what influence or impact the use might have on difficulties in school, whether it's with grades and performance or behavior, dropping out of activities, changing friends. A whole range of things that aren't necessarily as noticeable in older adults, sometimes stand out with adolescents. If you have a child, for example, in September of any given school year, lives and dies for athletic activities, and by April or May, just doesn't seem to have much interest, isn't trying out for teams that they would have, is dropping out of athletic activities, asking about whether or not drinking and drugging has something to do with it is absolutely mm-hmm. appropriate and necessary when you're looking at young people. Family relationships and how they're changing, relationships with friends, anything around emotional development, very critical to ask detailed questions about, and whether the young person has ever used anything to feel more comfortable in a social situation, if they've ever turned to any mood-altering chemicals, a way of dealing with stress or something that they find distressing. All important questions, but all need to be asked in some detail.
So I'm wondering, Brad, in addition to getting an idea of changes in behavioral patterns, what else would be important for the clinician in assessing chemical use amongst teens?
A thorough and comprehensive using history is always critical. Now, that's true of adults as well as adolescents, but particularly with adolescents because, on balance, compared to a middle-aged person, for example, you're dealing with a far briefer using history. The amount of time the person has been using is necessarily going to be less than an older person. I mean, they just haven't been around that long. If you're assessing a 45-year-old, you could easily have 30 years of time to look at. With the 17-year-old, it may only be 3 or 4 or perhaps less. So being as specific as possible is more critical with adolescents. Now, when I say specific, two categories right off the bat come to mind. One has to do with frequency. Mm. In other words, how often is this person using all mood-altering chemicals? And again, note the emphasis on the word all. The vast majority of addicts, the vast majority of folks who are experiencing any sort of trouble as a result of their use of mood-altering chemicals want to compartmentalize it. In other words, what I'm going to focus my attention on is the drug that seems to be causing my problem in my perception. Now, if I'm using 3 or 4 different mood-altering chemicals, what I'm going to speak with you most about is the one that I think is the focus of attention and may say nothing at all about anything else I'm using. If the therapist isn't tuned into that, they may not ask about others. Questions such as, well, have you ever used blank? Tell me about your use of blank. Any sort of follow-up question that specifically identifies a mood-altering chemical is always useful. Mm-hmm. And I always put a tag on it, even one time. So another thing that a lot of folks who use will do is create a false threshold. In other words, if I haven't used it at least X number of times, 5 times, 10 times, 15 times, or if I don't believe I ever got in any trouble, it doesn't count. So those things that I used 1, 2, 3 times, I'm not going to mention to you. I'm going to pretend they don't exist because they haven't reached that threshold. So I'm always asking questions in a way that are open-ended and yet ask for specifics, and that even one time tag is a very important one. So when you're talking about frequency, how many days per week? Now, one of the ways that I'll catalog that and help the person understand what I'm asking about, and then also help them see the reality of their use, is I may draw a calendar on a piece of paper. I'll be sitting there talking with the person, take a blank piece of paper, draw a rectangle, 4 horizontal lines, 6 vertical lines that create, you know, 4 weeks of 7 days, mm-hmm. and begin simply putting X's in boxes that represent days. Person says, well, I only use on weekends. Well, every weekend? Well, pretty much every weekend. Well, then I'll put X's in the Friday, Saturday, Sunday boxes. Follow up with a question such as, so you never use on a weekday? Well, sometimes. Well, okay. About how many in a week? Then there may be a response, 1 or 2. Well, I'll put an X in a weekday box. That visual will help the therapist get a sense of a clearer sense of the frequency of the person's use. It will also help stimulate them to begin thinking about their use in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. Rather than saying, oh, almost never, and almost never means, 3 out of 7 days a week. Well, no, look at that. I mean, that's almost 50% of your time. Almost 50% of the days, in a month, you're using mood-altering chemicals. It's very different than almost never. So that sort of clarification is very useful. Second set of questions around specificity regards quantity. Mm-hmm. And this is where a little bit of knowledge of so-called street drugs can be helpful, but it really isn't all that essential. The vast majority of folks who use can be very clear with you about how much they're using, what the quantities mean, and always, if you don't understand a term, ask. One of the things, for me it's an axiom, it's impossible for anyone to keep up on all of the street jargon, all of the latest terminology referring to using mood-altering chemicals. You just can't do it. Mm-hmm. So don't feel that somehow to be an expert you have to have this extensive glossary in your head. Just ask the person, well, what does that mean? I haven't heard that term before. And, don't feel self-conscious that there might be something you don't know. The reality is you don't. But I'll ask, when you're using, how much? And then it's a process of refining whatever the response is. Any vague general response, the follow-up question is going to have to do with getting that clearer, more focused, more specific. Frankly, one of the examples I use to illustrate this is from my own using history. The last time I actually used in my own home, once upon a time, someone would ask me, well, I was using alcohol exclusively at the time. Someone were to ask, well, how many did you have? I could easily respond, a couple. If the follow-up question is, well, what does a couple mean, which is always a good question, mm-hmm. I would honestly say two. But this is where thinking more specifically in greater detail and with a little bit of cleverness comes into play. Well, describe the two for me. How big was, what was it, first of all? Well, I was drinking rum. In a glass or out of the bottle? Well, it was in a glass. We'll describe the glass. To cut to the end, what it was I had a 16-ounce Tupperware tumbler, and I put I had two of those, put three ice cubes in, and ice cubes generally run about an ounce of water each, and I filled up the rest with rum. Mm. Now, the question that ought to pop into someone's mind is, okay, what was the proof of the rum? In other words, what was the percentage of alcohol right. by volume? In this case, it was 151 proof, which meant it was 75% alcohol. Mm-hmm. I had two of those. In a 16-ounce tumbler with 3 ounces of water consumed by the ice cubes, that meant there was 13 ounces of other liquid in there. Two of those meant it was 26 ounces. You do the math, you multiply that by 75% alcohol. I drank about 19 ounces of alcohol. Mm. Now, another good specific follow-up question is, over what period of time did that mm-hmm. take place? And it was about an hour and a half. Now, just with that piece of information alone, I've given any assessor quite a bit of information about me. Right off the bat, what should be absolutely clear is I had one whale of a tolerance at that point, that I could consume that much alcohol in that short a period of time, and I was able to get up, walk, talk, and appear to be functioning. Because I did have quite a tolerance. Mm-hmm. But you don't get at that unless you ask those more specific, return to the same topic sorts of questions. Now, why that's so important with adolescents is they're not used to speaking in those terms or thinking in those terms. They're generally immediately suspicious when any adult is asking them about their drinking and drugging, mm-hmm. and they're going to be looking at covering and coming up with some sort of answer that will satisfy the questioner but really provide very little information. And returning to those refining questions is absolutely critical to establish the potential for tolerance, what withdrawal the person might experience, just looking at the range of the person's use. In other words, how much of the person's life in terms of time, you know, is being committed to it. And another axiom that I like tossing in here is simply there's always more. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's absolutely critical and clear when you're talking about mood-altering chemicals is whatever the person says, there's always more. There's something they haven't told you. And you can continue to ask something such as, what else? Well, could you elaborate on that? Continue that on and on and on, and the person's not going to run out of information. I mean, there is, literally. There's always more that the person can tell you. So don't hesitate to do that, even if you feel, repetitive. Because remember, this person is more committed to not providing you with information than providing you with information. So you have to keep returning to that. A third area involving specific information you want to know from kids is the result. What happened? Okay, well, you used this, that, or the other thing. You were in this place. Well, what happened after that? What was going on? Because frequency and quantity by themselves are really never sufficient to establish a diagnosis of addiction, mm-hmm. but it's what was the result of that use, and getting as specific as possible, especially around any activity about which the young person might feel any guilt, any shame, any fear, any sense that they violated some family norm, their own personal code of ethics, morals, and values. You know, getting at the core of those experiences is absolutely critical. Now, again, if you have this drawing of a calendar, all this information that you're gathering can simply be written into the various boxes, and when you're done, for yourself, you have a clear representation of the person's pattern of use, the behavior related to their use, and some of the emotional baggage associated with it, but you also have something you can present them with that will probably be the first time they've ever seen the whole picture together.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a moment, that's a critical moment for a lot of addicts, because we are so used to minimizing, diminishing, explaining away, compartmentalizing anything related to drug and alcohol use, that to literally hear in our own voice and see on a piece of paper the sum total of what we've described, for a lot of people it's a shock, and especially for adolescents, because they generally go weekend to weekend, don't connect them, and you know, they don't think in terms of you know, a whole month, a whole summer, a whole season of the year. They're mm-hmm. just looking at the immediate past, which, well, that wasn't so bad. It wasn't that big a deal. But when they start looking and realizing that that wasn't such a big deal experience has occurred every other day, every third day for the last 4 or 5, 6 months or a couple of years, that can really be an important moment for them.
It seems like it's an eye-opening experience for most teenagers to really see graphically their use and the subsequent consequences. I'm kind of wondering how that information then is conveyed or used with the parents.
Excellent question. Because that has to do with another critical component of any assessment process. Again, adult or adolescent, but especially with adolescents, is the gathering of collateral information. When you're working with adolescents, you need to cast a very, very wide net. What important persons and institutions are involved in the young person's life, and what information do they have or suspect they have about their use?
Mm-hmm.
Parents, school, and various people in the school setting, any other extracurricular activities are involved in, such as athletics, those young people who've been involved with the juvenile justice system, getting in touch with their probation officer, collecting as much information about them as possible, adding that to the picture as well. Now, usually, with your typical adolescent, no one person is going to have a great deal of information on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Even with parents, you can take it to the bank that mom and dad they have not told each other everything they know about their child, their child's use, or what they suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Parents simply keep some things to themselves. They'll talk with each other about some aspects of their child's life, but there are going to be some things they just don't want to share. You pull all that together, you get a more comprehensive picture. Then what you talk to the parents about after you've gathered all this is laying out for them as complete and comprehensive a picture of their child as possible. What their child has said, you know, regarding their use, their pattern of use, the behavior related to it, what has come from various other sources, and, you know, look for the commonality, look for the patterns, look for the trends. And then talk with the parents about their level of awareness.
Mm-hmm.
I've never yet, in 26 years, talked with any parent who was aware of everything. I mean, my parents just aren't. Even with my own boys, there was a lot with both of them that I was just unaware of. You know, being a recovering addict myself, working in this business with adolescents for a very long time, you know, it just doesn't happen. You don't go home and, you know, suddenly everything is crystal clear to you. So it's an important process for parents to experience. Part of that simply has to do with natural adolescent development, normal adolescent development. as children grow, develop, go through the process of individuation, I mean, all the things they're experiencing, they are starting to separate and create a very clear, distinct identity in life away from the home and the family. A lot of parents aren't as clear about that process as they could be. One of the things that happens for a lot of parents is they look at their children and don't see them even the age they are. There's a little bit of lag. I mean, I still do that. I've got a 32-year-old daughter, and it's I still have to catch myself thinking, yeah, she's 32. I sort of have this mental image of her in mid-20s. And with my other children, it's the same thing. There's a little bit of lag in there. And if you're talking with a parent about a 15- or 16-year-old child, it's not uncommon for them to have a mental image of a 12- or 13-year-old. Really not, understanding or being aware of all the changes that have taken place. Mm-hmm. You throw mood-altering chemicals in the mix, and it's even less likely that they're going to be as aware. The reason it's so critical to get the parents involved is they are going to be the prime motivators for adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
Seeking treatment, acquiring treatment, experiencing treatment, and to a large degree being successful in treatment. A number of years ago when I worked at St. Luke's Hospital in Cleveland, we did outcome studies on our patients. And the two variables that always stood out above and beyond all others that indicated the adolescent patients doing well post-treatment as opposed to those who did not, number one, always at the top of the list, was family involvement. Family involvement in their ongoing treatment, family involvement in 12-step programming, general family involvement in the in the child's life and recovery. The second was the adolescent's own participation in 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. But the family piece was always either in first or second position, depending upon the particular sample we were looking at. So parents are incredibly vital, and they need education. They need help to understand that their child's use isn't just a phase. It's not something that all kids do. While it may be common and typical for adolescents, it's not normal, and they play a great role in their child's health.
So you're looking at, obviously, the family component. The parents is an integral part of treatment and then relapse prevention, but also 12-step meetings. One final question I have for you today is a little bit about chemical dependency in terms of the treatment approach. Are there certain guidelines or certain expectations you would have about what would constitute a well-rounded and beneficial treatment facility or treatment approach?
Sure. For adolescents, there are some critical and clear characteristics. Not in any particular order. One, adolescents need, require, even desire, although they generally won't say it, structure, a lot of structure. Now, this could be said of all addicts, given the fact that addiction thrives on chaos, and as folks slip into greater and greater disorganization and chaos in their life as a result of addiction, it's even more critical for adolescents. Because pieces of work that adolescents are doing, are developing, a greater sense of individual responsibility, participation in a community, and complying with expectations and structures, in those communities. So the treatment programs have to be even more structured than what you might expect in a typical American high school. The schedule needs to be very clear from the time the person wakes up in the morning till the time they go to bed, building in some free time so that the person has some responsibility for selecting their activity. But a lot of it being predetermined, structured in such a way so that therapeutic activities are engaged throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
So structure, routine, clear expectations regarding behavior, hygiene, cleanliness and organization of personal space, and a program that has clear built-in consequences for not complying with those things. A very important piece for adolescents. A high staff to patient ratio. One of the most obvious differences between adult programs and adolescent programs is simply the number of staff that are required. Mm-hmm. Now that runs counter to, common wisdom. You might think, well, you know, they haven't used as much, may not be, as difficult to work with as older adults. But the reality is, kids really require more attention, more staff involvement, and not necessarily younger staff. That common wisdom that, the younger the staff member, the better they're going to be able to relate to the kids, really doesn't work out at all. Mm-hmm. A diverse, balanced staff, both in terms of age, gender, race, cultural background, all of those factors is a far better mix. But a lot of staff, so that the adolescents are interacting with adults, interacting with a variety of adults, being monitored by a variety of adults throughout their day is a critical piece. Mm-hmm. Programs that are committed to abstinence and expecting their patients to participate in 12-step programs are also very critical elements. The reality is, for an addict, safe, normal, social, fill in the blank with whatever word you'd like there, use of mood-altering chemicals isn't going to be in the cards. Mm-hmm. An addict, a person with an addict brain, is going to trigger and revivify whatever addicted behavior they were involved in if they resume use at any point. So abstinence is critical. And developing, participating in, and maintaining a good, solid 12-step program throughout life is going to provide the person with the orientation and tools to be able to maintain that. Think about groups such as Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and so forth, is that it's not just about does the person use or not in any given day, but what else are they doing with their life? Are they improving the quality of life? Are they increasing their functioning? And that's critical for any addict, but especially adolescents. They're just beginning. I mean, they're dealing with developing and formulating their hopes and dreams. How are they going to live them out? And having a good, solid foundation in a recovery community and program is going to give them the best chance to do that. Mm-hmm. So programs that are very clear about their commitment to those two aspects of recovery, very important. The last, last simply because for no reason other than I'm just saying it now, a lot of group therapy. The backbone of any good recovery or treatment program, rather, is group therapy. Mm. It's simply irreplaceable for addicts first coming to terms with dealing with their active addiction and making a commitment to work in a recovery program. Individual therapy just pales by comparison. Now, folks may think the connection you have with an individual doing individual work is just so much greater than what it appears to be achieved in a group session. But the reality is, I mean, there's not an addict, and even the youngest adolescent addict, getting over on, getting around, pulling the wool over the eyes of any individual therapist. I mean, it just happens over and over and over again.
Sure.
But in that group setting, they get support, but they also get challenged. They're sitting there with people looking at them and saying, yeah, I know what you're up to. I know what game you're playing. Look at how defensive you are. And it's just far more difficult. So group therapy really needs to be the essence of any good treatment program, supplemented by individual counseling, but the group work just can't be replaced.
That sounds good. Well, I appreciate your time and talking to us today about the assessment and beginnings of a treatment process. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Brad Price by CAS contributing editor Amy Friedling regarding adolescent chemical dependency.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.